The Sunstone Foundation presents Sex and the Single Mormon, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel Utah in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
On time, one or more of the panelists is anxious. Just a reminder, there is no tape recording allowed. Can you hear me? What do I have to do? Does that sound good? No taping. There will be tapes available upon request, but no taping in this session, please. So on to the topic. We welcome you and are glad that you've attended this session of the Sunstone Symposium. We presume that you have an interest in the single Mormon. Each panelist is going to take from 15 to 20 minutes, and I'll try to keep them to 20 minutes so that we have a few minutes at the end of the session for questions and comments. I'd like to introduce the panelists in order of their speaking. Chris Allen, the baby, is a BS candidate at the University of Utah in psychology. He currently works and parents preschool children who have emotional problems at the Salt Lake City Children's Center. He, along with at least one or two other members of the panel, I'm sure, on this particular panel because of their very close association with the Sunstone Foundation. Chris is really a thoughtful person, I think very sensitive and an obvious person to share with us some thoughts. And then, secondly, we're going to hear from Ellen Richardson. She has a BS from BYU and is currently enrolled at the University of Utah. She's formerly a teacher, now director of the human resources at Bonneville Media Communications, which is a division of Bonneville International. Hope I'm getting all this correct. Both Peggy and Ellen are travelers, and Ellen just returned from delivering a paper around some employment issues in Oxford, England. She suggested that her most important qualification was that she agreed to do it. Thirdly is Peggy Watson. Peggy, you'll all know. She is from, where are my notes? I know she's from Houston. I don't know her very well and only got to meet her at the symposium, but one of the nice things about her is her address on Leafy Arbor in Houston. Doesn't that sound nice? Nice thing. While a fifth-generation Provo native, she has been in Houston almost 11 years, master's candidate in English, studying both creative writing and contemporary literature. She's an enthusiastic theater-goer as well as environmentalist. She has two teenagers, 16 and 13, and raising them singly. And lastly is Bellamy Brown, who I just met a few minutes ago. He's an attorney from Phoenix, Arizona, primarily doing law around real estate development, and he's recently married, just 2 months approximately, and he'll be our concluding panelist. Then we'll have a few minutes for questions and comments. I'd like you to say that Ellen Richardson responded to a note that I sent each panelist, and upon my request they responded, and she expressed a gladness that we would talk about such an issue so that we can all learn to live in harmony with both our sexual natures as well as our gods. She insists she's not anticipating many new answers, though she asserts a hope that we can gain some sense of community in a realization that we are not dealing with these or other issues in isolation. So let's begin by hearing from Chris.
I represent the only normal single on this panel. that was a joke. I represent the 23-year-old, recently returned missionary college student, and I had a tie and a white shirt upstairs, but I thought, this is more representative of me, so this is what I wore. In some ways, I feel a little bit like the man who wanted to tell everybody about the flood in his city, and he ran around telling them about the flood and finally got them all together at the townhouse to talk about this flood, and then found Noah in his audience. I don't know who is Noah out there, but in another way, I feel I enjoy talking and learning about sex, and I think that's why I was chosen for this. And if what the research says is right, there's two things on a college a student's mind, and first is his or her own self, and second is sex. And so I think about this quite a bit, you could say. Today we all met for lunch, and we all expressed our frustration of trying to solve the questions of the centuries here, how you balance religion and sexuality. And I expressed that I thought a lot about this presentation, and that I have just decided today that the best way for me to go about it is just to disclose some of my experiences and feelings in kind of as structured a way as possible. I've been accused of talking too openly about sexuality. Sometimes I'll bring up masturbation just off the wall at a party to kind of break the ice. But I wish more people would join in and talk. So, at 23, I'm at a point in my life where I'm really trying to internalize a lot of religious issues. I've been home from a mission in Hawaii for 2 years now, and sexuality seems to be the biggie, the big thing that you have to internalize. You can kind of, at least for me, I can, with a word of wisdom and tithing and issues like that, I can deal with them comfortably, but sexuality has really been the biggie to internalize and decide what kind of behavior I want to have. It's difficult because, for example, in preparation for this talk, there's no reading. No one writes a book on sexuality. You have the straight church line. No one talks about it in church except to give you that straight church line. And I've also found that even some of the most liberated, even the Sunstone crowd, may not talk about things such as masturbation and so on. And so there's not a lot of information out there. I'm a Sunday school teacher, and I took a poll a little while ago. I said, well, we can have this lesson on Zion's Camp, or we can have this lesson on human sexuality, and they voted for Zion's Camp. So I wanted a chance to talk, but it didn't work. I've found in my struggle to clarify religious values that sex seems to be a way, perhaps, that I push and I test my religious feelings, maybe almost a microcosm within which I explore principles such as obedience and free agency, my independence, my faith. Sex seems to be kind of a foundational issue that I can push against those and kind of brings me to ground zero about what I believe. Let me share with you an experience. As a missionary, when I'd been out about 9 months, I began having some pain, and I went to some doctors, and it was thought that it was possible that I had prostate cancer. Well, the doctor said, take these pills and masturbate. And I said, all right. And and then I called my mission president on the phone, and he was fairly strict and was the kind that had told us to tie our hands to the bedpost. But he said, all right, also. And so I began that. Unfortunately, it wasn't prostate cancer. I had some surgery. But masturbating under medical orders brought a new light to things. There wasn't guilt involved, and there wasn't... sometimes I would get up early in the mornings just to prove to myself that it wasn't just because I wanted to masturbate. It was strictly for medical reasons. But it kind of definitely brought a new light to it and opened up this issue of sexuality, and that maybe I wasn't going to try all my life to follow exactly what the church said on sexuality, that I was going to explore some new things. And so this is, as a missionary, since then, I've decided that I'm talking on masturbation right now, that it's a tremendous dilemma for a lot of people, Mormons especially, because who can say at least I can't say, whether masturbation is connected in some way with spiritual laws or whether it's something that's psychologically embedded so deeply in us. When we were young, it was forbidden and so on, that even the most liberating of thoughts can't uproot that guilt and so on in us. And so I've decided that a lot of people really struggle with it, and I've had talks with friends and so on, and sometimes they'll confess, sometimes they won't, and some of them, I believe, have never had experience in the area. Currently, I lean towards the side that says masturbation probably is not connected with spiritual laws as much as it just presents psychological problems as far as the way we feel inside when we do it is a function of our whole picture of emotional or of spiritual beliefs. I had a urologist that gave me one of the greatest paradoxes I've faced in saying that he talked to David O. McKay about people he should advise. As a urologist, he'd have to advise people to masturbate, and David O. McKay had said, well, there's certainly nothing wrong with masturbation, it's the guilt involved. And that took my brain for a spin, and still spinning, because I really don't, if it's the guilt involved, then let's just get rid of the guilt and have fun. But I lean to more towards that camp. I've also found that a lot of people struggle with it, and it can almost become neurotic in as far as this compulsive cycle of guilt after masturbation, this intense promise that I'm not going to do it again until next time, and then it happens, and then the cycle continues. And I broke the cycle by just not worrying about it and telling myself you're making it too big of an issue. And a wise bishop, as a recently returned missionary, I confessed that I'd masturbated, and he laughed and said, oh, you must be the only one, because nobody else does that. And he said, go get involved in some other things and don't worry about it. And since then, it hasn't been an issue. You don't know whether I do or don't, but it hasn't been an issue, I'll say that. I do believe masturbation can be a problem as far as avoiding relationships and those kind of psychological pathologies, but besides that, it's all right. The second thing I want to mention just briefly is petting and dating. Some of the other panelists are going to talk more about it, but my feeling is that it's really funny to think about the standards that we set when we date. You know, it's okay to have your shoes off, but touch above the waist, not below the waist, or it's okay to have shirt off, but not pants off. Or I'm not sure you can set those kind of legalistic restrictions, and my feel on that is that my whole theme today is going to be that it's more a relational issue. I want to talk about what would happen if you decided to become sexually active as a Mormon single and you were still active in the church. And the theme of this is be relationships. I'm extreme enough as a young 23-year-old who knows nothing to say that my feeling for the New Testament is that Christ was a very relational person, and that I don't want to try and speak for him, but the feeling I get for that is that decisions, moral decisions, would be made upon relational characteristics or foundations. By relational ethics, I mean the difference between promiscuity and casual sex and committed relationship sex and committed to marry relationship kinds of sex. I'm in the camp that I think if you're going to have premarital sex, that it's best to do that within a committed relationship. But I'm also have abandoned recently the intellectual argument that I told myself for a long time, that it was irresponsible to have sex, the full sexual experience, with a fairly uncommitted relationship. I could be accused of saying that technology changed a spiritual law as far as birth control, but I would accept that accusation. My feelings are that perhaps it's all right if someone... It's just not a moral issue to me anymore, and I'm young, and I may change my mind on that, but it's more a relational issue, a morality within the relationship and an honest relationship. Let me just present some of the problems that if someone decided to become sexually active, they might run into. First of all, I think post-thought is quite different than pre-thought. If someone could argue themselves or convince themselves, sincerely convince themselves, that it would be okay to have a full sexual experience outside of marriage, and then if they were to go do that, I think they're, and I don't want you to speculate whether I'm talking from personal experience here, but I think that they're in for a big surprise, almost a shock of how different that experience would be than they had previously thought it out to be. For example, most people that may decide that would have been involved in heavy petting or so on earlier. I think penetration, actual sexual intercourse, is a heavy issue, and that a Mormon taught not to do that his or her whole life, and then doing that outside of marriage is no matter how psychologically in tune they may be with themselves, convincing themselves that they can handle that, I think they're in for a surprise when they do that. They may realize that they're dealing with the procreative process, and that and they may be able to adjust to that, but I think it's a very serious issue. Sometimes my friends will come up to my house and we all sit around and we talk about sex sometimes, and my mom will be there, and she just says, "Why don't you guys just go jump in the sack and get it over with and get it off your mind?" And I think she's kidding, but what I know she's kidding, but what she says has a good point to it. We think about it quite a bit, and it can, at least for my age, it kind of becomes sex is marriage and this big thing that's going to happen when we get married. And maybe, as with masturbation, it's a serious issue, but maybe there's a good point to that, that if somehow we have to get it off our minds, and I'm not saying go do it to get it off your mind. But. Second, if a person decided to be sexually active, I think it's not necessarily a personal experience if you're an LDS man or woman. It's... You would wake up in the morning and tell yourself that it was a personal experience, and then a lot of things would come out of your soul that you realized that you may not have wanted to do that, and that that there were a lot of things inside trying to convince you not to do that. Third, I'm convinced that behavior sometimes can lead to attitudes change and vice versa, but having a sexual experience over a long period of time may lead to a vacation from the church, and I'll explain why, possibly a permanent vacation. I think sex or a serious behavior that's different from the church line can force you to evaluate exactly what you think. It kind of brings you down to ground zero, and you say, okay, I'm having sex. Am I going to go to hell, or am I going to be okay? What do I believe in? How do I want to deal with this? And if there aren't very many strong religious beliefs there in the first place, and you've had this sexual experience and you look at it and you may say, well, I guess maybe I really don't believe in what the prophet says, and I maybe really don't believe that he's a prophet. And we kind of have a trap in the church that says, well, you're spiritually darkened. But I don't believe that. I think that by having the sexual experience, you kind of force yourself to ground zero, and if there's nothing there, then you may leave the church. And then if you leave the church, of course you're going to go through a great deal of identity confusion and guilt and so on. So that's something to consider. However, leaving may be appropriate. I think sex can be a way out for people who don't feel like they want to face the stigma of someone who doesn't have faith or doesn't believe a sexual experience, we kind of classify in our mind, well, that person had sex, and so they're leaving the church, and maybe they just didn't want to say, I don't believe in the church, and leave, or maybe both. I think some people are able to compartmentalize their lifestyles when they leave the church, within the church, be a sexually active person, and also be active in the church. I would think that would be really difficult. Some people may be able to be completely honest with themselves, have a sexual lifestyle, believe in the church, and feel whole about it. But unfortunately, we never hear about those people, because if they told us about it, they wouldn't be in that lifestyle anymore. One more thing that I just want to say about if you chose to have a sexual experience is that we follow a way of life and teachings and advice within our church, and if you have that sexual experience, you find yourself confronting issues that they write about in Esquire and Vogue magazine. Just the common sense issues of, well, at least for a Mormon, we associate sex with commitment, and other people in the world may not, and you'll have to partner. Benefits of having the experience, certainly it feels good, I suppose. Sometimes it's a way for people to kind of sort out their psychopathology. They have a sexual experience, and they, I don't believe religion is psychopathology, but it's a way that they can get out and look at religion objectively and then begin to develop their own healthy view of religion. In summary, then, I want to say that it's really hard to talk about sex to a group of people. But I wish we would do more of it, because my sexual we had a little contest the other day, who's the most sexually frustrated? I don't know who will win. You guys can, we got a plaza meter or something here. But certainly I'm frustrated, and I'll admit that, because I don't know how to handle some of my beliefs with my sexuality. I feel like I'm a sexual person. I wish people would talk about it. I wish we could talk about it in sacrament meeting, in Sunday school, instead of some of the other things that we talk about. I think, as I said before, sex represents more than just hormones. It represents, for me anyway, a way that I can confront my religion and challenge my religion. And having advice on how to deal with that sexual issues would also help me on how to deal with my religious beliefs. So, saying that I believe in open discussion, I'll leave the next panelists to solve the problems.
I would give a pretty penny to know what brings each of you here today. Sex or singles, Judy's question. When asked to address the topic, my first thought was, can sex and single Mormons be said in the same sentence? They are virtually mutually exclusive to the minds of many. I explained to a friend of mine that I was going to discuss the topic, and he suggested that I should entitle it A Study in Guilt Without Sex. I am single, and I am Mormon, and I want to talk about that experience in terms of my sexual identity, my dealing with that part of my life, my experience. I would prefer vastly to be discussing this with two or three of you in a quiet setting in my home over a Diet Pepsi, with the assurance that we had a mutual understanding of each other and that you would know what I meant and would understand me. It's pretty threatening, frankly, to stand up here and say a few things that are deeply personal to me in this setting without the assurance or the feeling that comes sometimes in smaller groups that we are mutually understood. For that reason, I'm going to read most of the remarks that I prepared for today, because I genuinely want to communicate what is in my heart and communicate it appropriately. So bear with me when I read these remarks. I think part of my qualification for being here, the reason that Peggy asked me to approach the subject, was I am what my mother refers to as one of those who never married. You have to say that with a suitable amount of sigh, and she's got it down to a science. I am regrettably no expert on the subject. I think I've simply expressed myself too many times too verbally in the presence of Peggy Fletcher. But I think the subject is a legitimate one, and I think it's long overdue for some candid, caring discussion in a forum such as this. It is deeply important to many of us who seek to respond joyously, appropriately, to our sexual nature, as well as to our God. I attempt today no revealing view of my own necessarily private sex life, or lack thereof. It would serve only to obscure the issue with embarrassment both to you and to me. I wish instead to deal publicly in this forum with questions, ideas, concerns, dilemmas, conclusions, which are mine and perhaps yours, as I consider my attempts to reconcile appropriately my sexual nature and my relationship with God. Some of these perspectives are solely mine. Some of them are composites of my own thoughts and those of friends and associates, and some are solely those of others, which I feel compelled in honesty to at least represent here. I will make no attempt today to reflect or identify the official church stance on these issues, only my own understanding and feelings about the church's position as I perceive it to be. As I prepared these remarks, I found my thoughts falling into two quite separate categories as they relate to the issues of sex, marital status, church standing, and relationship with God. The first I do not choose to detail or spend a great deal of time discussing at this time because I believe that it has been adequately covered in other sessions and perhaps could be covered again in others. I want simply to identify it and then move on. I found myself questioning or finding these two very separate paths evolving, the one of sex roles and the other of the role of sex. In relationship to the first, sex roles, I find myself asking penetrating questions regarding is God identified by sex or sexual characteristic? If so, is he male? Is the authority to act in God's name a function of sexual characteristics, male versus female identification for priesthood eligibility? I've often wondered about sexual activity in the eternal world. Is it restricted only to those who inhabit the highest degree of the celestial kingdom, specifically those with celestial, parentheses, polygamous marriages still intact? Are all of us, the rest of us, eunuchs? Will I, by remaining unmarried in mortality, have forfeited, even in the eternities, the opportunity for sexual expression or even a sexual nature? What if I choose not to marry there, as I have chosen not to here at this point? My soul pulls back in pain from my present understanding of the church's position on any of the above questions. I am genuinely troubled by sex roles as they are interpreted in our current church and social system. The idea that boys have priesthood and leadership within the home and outside the home, and that a girl's role is motherhood, primarily exercised in the home and other charitable areas. Sexual activity legitimized only or even primarily for the purpose of procreation is troublesome to me as well. I cannot accept sex as a limiting or even identifying characteristic of my ability to seek and receive inspiration, to lead or to inspire or govern or exercise my righteous influence in whatever sphere it may be needed or appropriate. I cannot accept reasonably that maleness is prerequisite to acting in God's name or that priesthood is in any way equal and commensurate responsibility with motherhood. I believe that fatherhood is and ought to be that. Sex roles as a reason for giving or withholding blessings and privileges in the kingdom seems to me a misrepresentation of what godhood and priesthood really entails and means. With that brief but pointed discussion, I will leave that issue and deal for the remainder of my time with the issue of the role of sex in my life and in the life of others. The primary questions that arise to me as a single Mormon, perhaps in some cases to those of you who are married, are these. When do I have it? Under what conditions do I engage in it? With whom? Why should I? Why not? What options do I have? What problems do these options present? And what compensations do I have for remaining chaste? And what did I learn and believe about myself as a result of the church's position on sexuality during my formative years? That is a pretty profound area to me right now, and I want to share a little bit of insight on it with you. Without delving into an in-depth and unnecessary biographical review of my life, I feel it important nonetheless to set the scene for my present position by a brief overview of the road till now. I was born under the covenant, reared in a small, rural, intensely Mormon community by very mainstream, conservative, believing parents in the 1950s and 60s. I don't recall the word sex ever being mentioned expressly in my home. If it was, it was never done so casually. These were years and a home in a church environment when the typical object lesson on chastity actually was of the chewed gum or crushed gardenia variety. I was told with great conviction by my mother on many occasions during my teen years that she would rather see me dead than unchaste. And I can remember her saying with piercing eyes, "I would rather drive the nails in your coffin than have you come home and tell me you had lost your virtue." Now, I wasn't at all sure of what my virtue was, but Lord knows I was interested in not losing it. I want to tell you an experience which to you may seem extreme, but to me it was perhaps the very foundation. I was 12 years of age and attended a Christmas party at the Kiwanis Scout House where we were dancing boys and girls. I mean, you know, not the lunchroom variety where you dance with the other girls, but this was real stuff. And I was 12, and the only kid around that I was really interested in was a young man by the name of Lynn Pack. Lord, I hope Lynn is not in the audience. If you do, don't admit to this. Lynn kissed me on the cheek. I was horrified. I can remember it was December. It was a Christmas party. I ran all the way home, which is about 3/4 of a mile, and burst into my parents' home sobbing. My mother said, "What's wrong?" And I sobbed, "I've lost my virtue." She immediately got very serious. She sat me down and said, "Who did it?" Number one question, who has done this thing? Lynn Pack. She called my father, he readied the shotgun, and it was pretty intense there for a few moments. Finally, she got calmed down enough to say, "What did this man do to you?" And I said, "He kissed me." She didn't even smile. She simply said, "Well, dear, you haven't lost your virtue," and calmed my father down. And it would have been a really nice opportunity to explain, I think, what virtue was, but we didn't take that opportunity. And I was vastly relieved I hadn't lost it, but I still didn't know what it was. It was a difficult experience, and I can remember on other occasions those painful discussions with my mother in which she tried to educate me and I tried not to be educated. And I can remember exclaiming in frustration, "How will I ever tell my children about this if you don't tell me?" And she responded that by the time I had children, I'd know enough to tell them. I think she's still planning to have a discussion with me the night before my marriage if I go through that rite of passage. As nearly as I could piece it together in those formative years, the picture was this. Sex was for procreation only. It was my duty, not necessarily enjoyable. It was for marriage relationships only, and I must never go, quote-unquote, too far. My virginity was to be my greatest gift to my future husband. He would want it, expect it, and be understandably ready to reject me as a marriage partner if I could not bring it to him intact. It was my job to preserve it against the insidious attempts of many men to steal it without paying the price of marriage. I literally tried to wear, from the time I was 13 to 14 years of age, not to wear any clothing which would have been inappropriate if worn over temple garments. I want to tell you about some of the consequences of that experience. I developed a pretty poor sense of myself physically. As a physical sexual being, I had very little experience or very little feeling for myself, for the legitimacy of that. And I developed a pretty intense body hatred. It led to a period of real bout with overweight, with the desire to be kind of frumpy because sexy was bad. It developed in me a very mistrustful attitude toward the men in my life. I put in place a pretty powerful siege mentality. I knew what they were after. They were all after the same thing, and it was up to me to see to it they didn't get it until the appropriate time. It wrecked a lot of relationships or damaged them. And a denial of sexual interests, questions, feelings, and desires as being either dirty or premature in an unmarried woman or ungodlike. I think some of my male peers also got genuinely hung up on many of the same issues during that period, and for many of us, they remain unresolved into our adult views of ourselves. All of these things may have been resolved successfully had I married at an earlier age. However, even that transition, I think, has been difficult for many of my friends. I honestly never, in those years between 21 to 22, that prior to that time, ever thought that I would have to come to grips with my sexuality as a single adult Mormon woman. I was still wearing and defending my virginity as the great badge of special entitlement that I believed that it would be, the prerequisite to a happy temple marriage, the mark of a spiritually committed daughter of Zion. And then a transition began, the dawning realization that marriage might not be an imminent choice for me. giving way to the realization that it might not even be a late or never choice for me during my mortal period. I began and continue to deal with the realization that a significant period of my adult life may well be spent single by my own choice. The ramifications of that choice are very much upon me. I had really thought and genuinely hoped that as I aged, the issue of my sexuality would become less pressing, less a part of me, less an issue. But it hasn't, and it doesn't. Conversely, as I become more aware of myself as an adult woman with a growing understanding of myself and my needs, and my strengths, my weaknesses, my potential, my contribution, I become concurrently and happily more aware of my sexual needs, desires, and the problems I face in integrating them into my life and my spiritual orientation. I am deeply troubled by the realization that I have no sanctioned, appropriate, spiritually legitimate alternatives to celibacy or marriage for dealing with my sexuality. To commit myself to a life of celibacy at this point is not what I want. I find that an unacceptable, agonizing response. But equally unacceptable is excommunication for fornication, as is marriage that makes sense only as a way to legitimize sexual functioning. If and when I marry, I hope it will be for many, many reasons. But the scriptural options and advice given by Paul regarding it being better to marry than to burn seem both unreasonable options to me. I don't want to do either right now. With whom do I discuss the dilemma? Do I, like many have that I know, provide an elaborate protocol of what is and is not acceptable, as Chris alluded to? Is it above or below the neck? Was what I mean, you know, that's what they always told me. If they moved it to the waist, I'm terribly relieved. I am at last managing some acceptance of my feeling about being sexual as an eternal characteristic of mine, an acceptable characteristic, but my heart aches for LDS friends who are having some concerns and fights in those areas also. The range of how-tos among the LDS singles is, I think, really great, very broad. I was discussing the other day with my friend, she was telling me about her counseling session with the married women in her ward. This is a single friend, and she was giving them some counseling on oral sex, hoping that it might improve their own marriage relationships. She's the resident expert on that because she involves herself in it, feeling that it represents an acceptable sexual expression within, still safely within the guidelines of the church that she engage in no sexual intercourse outside of marriage. I think the coping mechanisms run from that extreme through masturbation, as Chris talked about, lots of cold showers, a rich fantasy life. A lot of people, I think, involve themselves heavily in business or volunteer concerns or exercise or anything else to the distraction of to distract themselves or to become involved with things that keep their minds occupied. I am troubled also by the dilemmas posed to many beautiful friends who are single in the church and whose careful, thoughtful, prayerful attempts at understanding themselves in relation to their sexuality has led them to the conclusion of their own homosexuality. Much pain and misunderstanding still shrouds our LDS attempts to deal with all of these issues. As I date LDS men and non-LDS men, I observe some pretty marked differences in the way they deal with the issues of sexual identity and conduct. In some cases, they are genuinely refreshing and warm differences, and in some cases, they're genuinely troublesome. I often ponder the relative merits of both perspectives, and I'm sure men find the same thing as they date women both in and out of the church. I want briefly to mention one other experience, and then I will close. My feeling about myself sexually cannot be discussed outside the context of my temple endowments, which I took out at the age of 21 prior to serving a mission for the church. I found the experience of covenanting with an imaginary future husband and committing my exaltation to an unknown intermediary kind of him and vowing to have sexual intercourse only with him severely affects my experience of the temple rites. Had I not taken those covenants, my penalties for sexual sin at this point in my life would be far less. And I raise the question with every single I know who has not yet taken endowments, are you sure that's what you want to do? I offer few, if any, solutions. I cannot bring myself to make any final decisions regarding the issue of chastity in my own life at this point. I can only make an uneasy truce for the present, but it's a ticking bomb. I am far from quiet in my heart, far from certain of what my God expects and wants from me in relationship to the issue. I genuinely want to believe that to the extent that I am a sexual being, I am also like him or her, that I'm created in their image, and I long to experience and express myself freely, joyfully, without guilt, fully, in a sexual way which doesn't rob me of any birthright or blunt my spiritual capacities and slow my spiritual maturity and growth. As to the question of the inspired nature of moral laws and interpretations thereof in the church stance, I find myself asking, what is the purpose of restrictions on sexual activity, even in marriage? Who determines what's acceptable sexual behavior or what's normal? What's the real function of sex? If it's for procreation only, if I take precautions not to involve myself in that situation, may I engage in anything I choose? Who drew up the guidelines? Whose business is it? I have a next-door neighbor who just got disfellowshipped, well, not just, some years ago, actually, for a sexual experience, who confided to me prior to rejoining the community of the church that it had been a very positive experience in many ways. It had lent her a whole new sense of herself, and that she learned a great deal from it, and it has some very positive and negative aspects to it. I think that there's a serious problem to be addressed by all of us in terms of how those of us who find ourselves in infraction with these laws interface with the body of the church. In conclusion, let me say that I would not deny, as most will not deny, that current church strictures against indiscriminate sexual activity are wise and timely guidelines to protect us from frightening and potentially debilitating disease. In this light, they are sensible and safe measures, safeguarding our health and our well-being spiritually as well as physically, I believe. I do, however, believe that there is a great difference between indiscriminate, unwise, unhealthy sexual promiscuity and considered appropriate sexual activity. This vast and nebulous gray area is admittedly one of my own making. It's difficult to define, difficult to monitor, and almost impossible to evaluate. I find myself wondering if it's similar, perhaps, to the many, many areas of concern to our physical health that are not spelled out in the Word of Wisdom, but nonetheless meriting careful, prayerful consideration as we seek to care for our bodies in accordance with the Lord's will. I hope there's perhaps some similar room for personal evaluation of our sexual health and activities while still remaining within God-given guidelines. I wish I felt better about what those guidelines are, but I believe there is room for that evaluation carefully and prayerfully within the church community. Thank you.
I kind of tend to think that the reason you're all here is because you're closet singles. What I'm wondering is what am I doing here? A recent newspaper article announcing the symposium stated that those accomplished in a field of study were being asked to give papers or share in panels. And in this case, being accomplished simply means being single. Now, in my case, it also means having gone through marriage to get to the single. I think that many of us in this room are accomplished here and probably equally perplexed. And it's with mixed feelings that I share my perplexities with you. Incidentally, I confront this subject occasionally with very intimate friends. I feel the same way that Ellen does. I've never done this before in a room full of strangers, and back in Houston in my own home ward. So I wrote out my talk because I didn't want to back myself into a corner by mistake, and I'm going to try to stick to it. It's been interesting during the rest of the conference. We've had this great meeting of the minds during these past 3 days, and here all of these things have been going on in session after session, and I've kept finding myself clicking back to sex. It's been disarming. When Ellen and I talked before this session about what we were going to talk about, it sounded to me like really I would be giving her talk right after she gave it, and she said, well, that's okay. You go ahead. It can be done twice just fine. And I told her, well, I'll just cross out the parts that you do that I don't need to do. And so the parts I'm crossing out are the eloquent parts. And also, I'm not going to deal with the broad scope. Rather, the personal experience. I'm going to talk more about my own personal experience and personal feelings. And so as not to embarrass anyone, I'll try to be vague. So that you'll know where I'm coming from. First of all, a brief personal background before I go into the personal experiences and personal feelings. I grew up in a home where sexuality was virtually non-existent, or at least kept under tight wraps. My mother was widowed at the age of 25. And my grandparents, whose home we shared, slept not just in separate beds or in separate bedrooms, but on separate floors in the house. And so my sexual role models became June and Ward Cleaver, and and Ozzy and Harriet Nelson, and also Emma Ray and David O. McKay. I did my dating first time around in Provo during the early 60s and the late 50s. I dated a lot, but strictly according to standard night guidelines. I liked feeling good about myself. I also liked being in control, not just of myself, but of the boys I dated. I took total charge of the rationing of my affection as if I were the great giver of life rationing water in a desert. I suppose I was the ultimate white rose, going back to the standard night images, the slice of bread with all my butter intact. And this wasn't all bad. In some ways, I'm even glad of this. It's a comfortable thing going through high school and college without guilt. But I really can't take credit for any profound self-mastery. Fact is, the chemistry of womanhood simply hadn't started surging within me at that point. It was intellect over emotion then, in those days for me. I like kissing above the neck, or maybe in a moment of reckless abandon on the neck. But I had no urgent desire to do much of anything beyond that, and I was rather intolerant of my boyfriends who did. My friends and I didn't talk to each other much in those days about our sexuality, some of us because there wasn't a whole lot to talk about, and others, I've since learned, because their hormones were functioning full speed. They were finding themselves outside their standard night boundaries, and they were troubled. I don't believe talking would have helped us much at that point. We were at such different levels of development that I don't think we really would have understood each other. I married right on schedule in the temple the same week I graduated from BYU, turned 22, and took on my first teaching assignment to work my returned missionary husband through his last years of school. And we seemed to have everything going for us, my young husband and I. We were energetic and full of aspirations, and we liked being close. But I was still a girl, although I didn't realize it at the time, and not a woman. I was looking forward to nesting more than full exploration of passion, I'm afraid. I was prepared for marriage, neither emotionally nor physically. I was still programmed for purity. Once a white rose, always a white rose, right? Incidentally, a friend suggested a better image than the rose, if what we still need is an image, that it might be that of a nuclear reactor. I like that better myself. But I wasn't programmed that way at the time. I wasn't programmed to react. And I'm sure those early years of marriage baffled my eager but unskilled husband. And ours was by no means an isolated situation. We were legion. The good news is this. Womanhood finally came to me. Again, right on schedule, according to Margaret Mead's research, in my 30s. And it felt fantastic. The bad news, it didn't come quite soon enough for long-term enjoyment in a marriage that had, meanwhile, suffered some very damaging blows in other areas. And just when I was getting into it, this time for once my timing was off. And I found myself at age 35, finally a full-blown woman with a full-blown separation, which became a divorce 3 years later. I've been officially single now for 2 years, and despite my grief at losing someone and something so important, and despite my damaged capacity to trust, and my injured ego and feelings of abandonment, my sexuality has never been in better form. It's like the 4th of July inside me. And I love the feeling, but I'm single and Mormon. So just how do I go about celebrating the 4th of July? I've observed the following options among my single friends. Number one, a few of them avoid the opposite sex altogether. One friend is so glad to be out of an abusive marriage that her singleness is all she wants. Another is alone by default because no one has discovered her. She would be delighted even to be able to say no. A male friend is too shy to risk possible rejection, so he doesn't date. And another is extremely particular and can't be satisfied, so he spends his evenings with his stereo. Number two, some friends establish a relationship and keep it innocent, but I don't know many adults who can maintain that for very long, especially when they're accustomed to thinking of hugging and kissing as foreplay. I do have one divorced friend who prayed to have her sex drive taken from her because she couldn't deal with it. She says her prayer was answered. Number three, some friends compromise, participating in masturbation and or petting, and trying or deciding not to try to come to grips with President Kimball's statement that this is the behavior referred to in the scriptures as like unto adultery. Fourth, others, while still loving the gospel and wanting it in their lives, choose to abandon church directives rather than live with frustration and deprivation. They sometimes fear that if they don't use it, they'll lose it, and that something inside them will die. They sometimes fear they'll miss something important. They deal with the accompanying guilt as best they can. And I personally can't think of any friends I have who are sexually active who don't have accompanying guilt. And if they lose their church membership as a result, then the suffering seems to be doubled. Finally, there are those who separate from the church entirely. The needs of the human body are powerful, and waging an endless battle can be exhausting. Could be the ideal option is to find the ideal mate and make it all legal. But not everybody wants marriage, and the process of finding takes time. And sex shouldn't be the reason for wanting to marry. And the male-female ratio being what it is, it won't happen for everyone anyway. Then, too, there's always the danger of finding the less-than-ideal mate, making it all legal, and regretting it profoundly. What works for one person doesn't necessarily work for another, and what makes sense at 20, the age of 20, may not compute at 40. My personal choice is to operate within the church's moral structure. For one thing, I, too, made that promise in the temple. For another thing, I value my church membership highly, and I can't, nor do I choose, to separate myself from it. Number three, I also have those two teenage children to whom I feel a tremendous responsibility to practice what I preach. And this is just an aside that may be interesting to you, but at a PTA meeting in Houston, an expert was speaking to a group of parents about disciplining children. And one father was confused about, can he ask his son to clean his room up when the father's room is not clean? And the expert in the field said, well, yes, certainly, you're the parent. You don't have to live by the same standards that your children do, unless, of course, you happen to be a Mormon. They do that. But I wouldn't want to, would you? That's what she said. Moreover, I think that there's much to be said for bridling passions. Self-mastery is a plus. And the concept of reserving such powerful bonding for marriage is a beautiful concept. But I'm a different person than I was 20 years ago. My sacred kiss ethic and rationing techniques seem a little absurd now. I don't take myself nearly so seriously. I'm not at all caught up in my power or self-importance. Mothering teenagers, if nothing else, tends to humble one. And I'm not into white roses or buttered bread anymore. After all, that saving myself is behind me now. Rather, I appreciate the capacities of my body, even to the point of rejoicing. I'm comfortable with my sexuality. I feel a wonderful freedom within my own skin. And if there happens to be a love interest in my life, I want to be expressive. The fact is, I learned more about loving from a very sweet man with whom I recently ended a year-long relationship than I learned even within my marriage. And it's not that my husband wasn't also a very sweet man. He was and is. But it took somebody else to fly me to the moon, someone who was a toucher, someone who taught me that every inch of my body, not just private parts, was alive and well and in need of tender attention. It was absolutely incredible. And it was done without intercourse, although it would have been a lot more fun if it had been. But I must confess, it was not without frustration. That relationship was wonderful, and it was not without frustration. So what will I do outside marriage? Or to borrow an Exponent 2 title, what do we do when we don't? When there is a warm relationship in my life, and for me the emotional caring has to come first, otherwise the physical closeness would make absolutely no sense at all, I will be close and express love as a woman within my own personal limits. When I'm out of my comfort zone, I'll know. I may be exhilarated, but I'll be distressed and I'll feel less freedom instead of more. So I will enjoy all the ways of loving that are available to me, and I will continue to fight the good fight against the ways that aren't. And it won't be enough. Less is not more in this case. A wave of loneliness passes over me every single night that I climb into my bed alone, and it possibly always will. But I will be nourished by what loving and what touching I have. According to a recent Ann Lander survey that you may have taken note of, the majority of women, even married women, would be happy for just this. And when there is not a love in my life, which there is not at the moment, darn it, I'll catch up on my reading, and I'll spend time with dear friends, and I'll get on with my life, and I'll relish whatever touching is available, hand squeezes, hugs from friends. I'll collect joy from as many sources as possible, and I'll still be lonely, and I'll hope for better times. I have a friend who is divorced who said that he knew before he was ever out of his marriage that it would be very, very difficult for him to be away from the sexual experience. That had been the best part of his marriage to his wife, and it lasted up until the day of their divorce, I believe. So he had his plan ahead of time. He decided that exercise would take care of it for him, and he has a bunch of weights in his closet, and whenever he gets frustrated, he goes and pumps the iron. And he says if he doesn't get married soon, he's going to measure 60 inches around the chest. I have another friend, a female friend, for whom the same thing was true. Sex was probably the only good thing in her marriage. And she held onto a marriage that was absolutely awful because she was afraid to do without sex. And as it turned out, once she was outside the marriage, she really couldn't last for very long. And it was just last week that she was disfellowshipped. But she has her plan of action. She doesn't want to be away from the church. She wants to be back in the church. She wants to be able to be obedient. And so she's finding whatever way she can to make herself happy and to feel good within her own body. She was saying that just the other day, she lives way out in the country, way outside Houston, in a very heavily wooded area, and she has her own farm, and she does mowing on this big power mower thing where she goes down to the bottoms, down where all the oak trees are, and mows. And it's very private there. And she said the sun was beating on her back the other day, and she was mowing, and she was feeling a little uncomfortable and perspiring. And if you've been to Texas, you can appreciate that. And she stripped to the waist and said how wonderful it felt to have that sun beating on her bare back and to feel a slight breeze going across her body. And these are the ways that she's going to find to be good for her to herself in the absence of those things that might be a little bit more satisfying. Some of us are still romantics, the formerly married, never mind that we've been hurt. We still have a few stars in our eyes, I think. Perhaps more even than those who've chosen to not marry. Those who choose to remain single don't have quite the same stars, I don't think. Now, I don't tell this to everyone. In fact, I hardly tell it to anyone, but I do harbor secret hopes for a second time around someday. And this with all the kissing and holding and touching and total ecstasy that the human body can contain. Statistics may be against me, but we're all entitled to our fantasies. I think that sex is far more than the world's view of it, and it's also far more than our standards nights ever indicated to us. It should be more than both combined. And someday, again, I'd like to be a part of it all.
When Peggy first called me and began to solicit my participation in this program, I was not certain this was exactly the way I wanted to spend Saturday afternoon. And she reminded me of all the commitments I made to her previously and one thing and another. And finally I said, well, okay, Peggy, but why do you want me? You know, there are lots of other people who are more articulate than I and more sensitive than I and more insightful than I. And she said, well, Bella, let me be perfectly honest, I've never known anybody who was old as you and really got married. I am 39 years old and have been married for 2 months, 10 days, and 4 hours. And having been single for a long time and having recently been married, let me tell you, for me, being married is much better. Because of the nature, the kind of the impressionistic nature of my comments, I thought that it might be appropriate to discuss for a moment or two my background, because obviously my background and experiences are going to influence my views about this most intimate and sensitive subject. I grew up as the middle of three boys in a family that had parents who had a warm and loving relationship. My two brothers, both the younger and older one, married at a rather normal age in their mid-20s, and I grew up outside of Utah, actually, except for the 4 years I spent at BYU. I've never lived in Utah, mostly in the East Coast, the West Coast, Florida, California, and for the last decade or so in Phoenix, Arizona. And as I trundled off from Florida to BYU, well, I had all the normal anticipations, going on a mission, returning from a mission, maybe, you know, getting married within 6 months after you got back to the mission field wasn't for me, but in a year or two or three, something in that range. And I'm quite certain that if I had been the age of others here, or if you'd asked me when I was 21 or 22 as I got back to the mission field, when I would be married, I would have said, oh, well, you know, 26, 27, something like that. I remember when I first went to New York City and met someone who subsequently became a very close friend of mine who had just turned 31 and was single. I couldn't believe that anyone could actually be that old and still be single. It just goes to show, things don't always work out quite as you anticipated that they would be. I would like to direct my comments primarily upon that area of the subject about which I know the most, and that means males primarily, and at this stage of my life, a little older segment of the single male population. I was 16 once, but that was a while ago. And I don't know that my remarks have much validity or, judging from this group, interest to us with respect to that age group. So unless I indicate to the contrary, I think my remarks would be concerned primarily single males of the age of 25 or so. When I was first drafted for this task and mentioned that I had, in a moment of weakness, accepted to my friends, I got both... These are friends both inside and outside of the church. I got one of two responses. The most common response was, when I told them the topic, was a, you're going to do what? Or how can you talk about that? Or very often, and actually perhaps more often, I got the response, well, you can't take more than about 5 minutes talking about that, can you? It should be over in a big hurry. Both these remarks, it seemed to me, are illustrative of a rather persuasive attitude that if you're a religiously committed member of the church and single, well, sex and sexual drives are either ignored or eliminated. I think there's an attitude that, if I may borrow from a phrase I heard last night, that if you're an Orem 54th Ward, If you're single, you either are or should be a eunuch. As we've heard expressed here already this evening, or this afternoon, that's simply not the case. Contrary to the comments of kids in my scout class, sex urges and drives don't suddenly disappear after you're 25 or 30 years old. And, in fact, they continue unabated. However, the problems caused by this kind of general attitude, I think, are manifold. Some years ago, I was called to what I believe to be, and I recognize there are others who would argue differently, probably the worst job in the church, and that's being the young special interest representative in a normal ward. I can remember being told by my bishop, who was in a position, a sensitive individual, and in a position to really have thought about these issues, that there's probably no group in the church that had more frustration or unhappiness or was more deeply involved in sin than that particular group. And as I reflect upon those experiences over the last 10 years, I think that assessment is unquestionably a correct one. Now, there aren't many hard statistics about this narrow population that we're discussing, but there are studies of other populations which I think prove to be very interesting. As many of you know, there are lots of studies about the longevity of single as opposed to married individuals. And the conclusion of the two studies on the subject that I've read is quite striking. That is, single men above the age of 25 have substantially shorter lifespans than any other group, including, interestingly enough, single women. Furthermore, I recently read a study concerning rates of diseases among Catholic priests, a group who, I might point out, have religious approval and sanction for their status. And that study indicated that Catholic priests have a much higher rate of stress-related diseases than any other group of the population generally. I think the conclusion is unmistakable. While being a member of the church may be healthy for you, being a single male over the age of 25 is clearly dangerous to your health. That alone, I guess, should be incentive enough to get people to marry. These general problems, the kinds of frustrations we've heard discussed here this afternoon already, I think are further exacerbated by certain social pressures on the single member of the church. And I'm aware, quite candidly, of the pressures that exist with respect to women as well as men. But as I will argue here in a moment, I think that they are perhaps more intense on single males. There's an attitude, and a rather pervasive one, that if you aren't married by the age of 30 and you're a male, then you're probably, as Brigham Young's famous saying has it, a threat to society, or at the very minimum, some sort of social liability. The attitude is, I think, reinforced by certain recent ecclesiastical decisions. As some of you may know, about a year ago, there was a decision that with respect to virtually all the singles wards in the church, which I may say have been very successful, that singles over the age of 30 were no longer encouraged to attend. In fact, they were not encouraged to attend, they were asked not to attend. It seems to me that this sort of approach carries a very strong message to singles both above and below the age of 30. Sometimes, however, the message is much more explicit. About 2 or 3 years ago, I was in Salt Lake on a business trip and just flew in on a Saturday and had occasion, the opportunity actually, to be here Sunday. So Sunday morning, while I got open my phone book and began to call around to various wards to really go to a singles ward, being aware of my priesthood responsibilities. And I finally tracked down the name of a single ward bishop. So I called him, introduced myself, explained that I was just in town for the weekend, and wanted to go to sacrament meeting, and asked him what time sacrament meeting was and where his ward was located. His first question was, how old are you? And frankly, I think I knocked a year or two off my age, but I told him that I was over 30, and he said, I'm sorry, you're too old, you can't come. Well, I went anyway, operating under the old missionary premise that it's easier to get forgiveness than permission, and quite enjoyed myself, but obviously there was a message being communicated there. The fundamental problem that we face is, as I mentioned, is the contrary to what I would have thought when I was 15. sexual desire continues well past the age of 30. If you were a eunuch, well, the whole thing would be very simple, but you're not. And as a result, it isn't simple. And the advice and the sort of homilies that permitted you to defer sexual gratification, repress an essential element of your nature when you're 18 or 20, don't work as well when you're 25 or 30 or 35. I really believe it's one thing to postpone experiences that are at the core of your own vision of yourself as a human being for a few years. It's another thing to face the problem of deferring them forever. As a Mormon, growing up in the church, you learn very early that sex is a sacred sort of thing, and that if you do everything right, that is, if you are active and you go to church and you get married in the temple and stuff, well, then not only do you have the benefits of sexual experience here, but the common discussion is that you also have the benefits of sexual activity eternally. And in fact, I've heard at least one fireside speaker at BYU argue that this was the principal motivation for being pure, was the opportunity to, you know, if you repress for just a little while here, well, you have this opportunity forever. And she was obviously of the opinion that was more than sufficient motivation for any right-thinking person to be straight. If, however, you know, that may be fine when you're 20, but a decade later, that sort of explanation doesn't work so well, particularly if you're faced with what I believe to be a kind of unique paradox that our theology seems to impose upon us. If we are straight and worthy and committed and active, but don't marry, I think the general position is quite clear. You end up as an ministering angel or something of similar status, and hence you don't have the opportunity for sex ever. If, on the other hand, you are perhaps less straight, less active, less committed, and you take advantage of the myriad of opportunities that present themselves here, well, your status vis-a-vis your sexual nature is no worse off in the eternities than if you hadn't done all those things here. Under either circumstance, you have no opportunity hereafter to realize your sexual nature. Now, obviously, there are problems with that argument, but I have heard that argument made in discussions of this topic among single Mormon males. Now, it seems to me that the same pressures do not exist, at least in exactly the same fashion, on single women. What is your normal response, or the response, let me say, of a member of Orem 54th Ward when confronted with the issue of a single Mormon female? I think the usual response is, oh, poor dear. Well, that's okay. She'll have an opportunity hereafter. You know, all of your losses will be made up to you in the afterlife. I've never yet heard anyone anywhere suggest that single Mormon males had a, quote, second chance, unquote, in the hereafter. These considerations, coupled with the phenomena that others have remarked upon, particularly last night, that men, whether inside or outside the church, are less willing to be celibate than women, and are probably less likely to deal with the dissonance in their lives caused by the conflict of being sexually active in a society that condemns that behavior, creates a situation you find, frankly, as you walk into virtually any older single ward, or, heaven forbid, any YSI dance, young special interest dance. Your first and immediate impression is, and question, where are all the men? Well, the fact of the matter is, there aren't many men over a certain age around. I have recently heard statistics apparently gathered by the Church Correlation Committee, and these are secondhand, but I have reason to believe that they're correct, that indicate that for every 19 active LDS single men over the age of 30, there are 100 active single women. I have very few, there are a few notable exceptions, but very few friends who have reached the age of 30 or more than a year or two over that, that are able, I see one of them smiling in the audience back here, who are able to remain active given this sort of situation. If you choose, it seems to me, to make the difficult decision to remain active in the church, and it is a difficult decision after a certain age, it is much easier for most, certainly my friends and associates, to kind of slip off with our numerous Gentile friends, then I think that you're required finally to develop your own sort of sexual ethic. We've heard some discussion of that already here tonight. I know that most singles early on in the game have to decide for themselves what type of behavior is consistent with their religious commitments and their personal needs. You learn to draw lines that other people may not understand properly. When I was a freshman at BYU, I was almost persuaded that it wasn't appropriate to kiss on the first date, and that making out, quote-unquote, which doesn't necessarily involve petting, wasn't appropriate activity before you were married. Frankly, as I get older, my attitude up until I was finally saved by some poor unsuspecting girl who married me was that you had to seize your opportunities when you got them because they didn't come very often. And it is possible to be literally cut off from the human race if you don't handle the situation properly. I've had friends, single friends who are active in wards, who have gone for months without any human contact whatsoever. You're past the age where you're surrounded by your family. You can't very well go and ask your mother who lives far away or is no longer alive to hug you. And unless you try very hard to have a very active social life, those opportunities don't come very often at all. Now, let me make it a little clearer that I'm not talking about necessarily a set of standards of behavior that differ from those set forth in the scriptures or what we hear in general conference. I really had a long, long time to think about this subject and have had an opportunity to observe lots of members of the church struggle with these same issues. And I'm not trying to play an advocate of a particular position, but it does seem to me that there are enormously destructive consequences to transgression of standards that you, at some point in your life, accepted. I've seen all sorts of attempts to deal with this issue. I've seen people try to compartmentalize their lives. I've seen people who've given up on the subject altogether, and I've seen people who've struggled with, at great cost, to be straight. I don't have any ultimate answer to these issues, but I don't think that for most of us who've made certain commitments and have sought to be active in this organization, that a choice to be sexually active is really a very satisfactory solution at all. Ultimately, I think we have to recognize that there are costs to discipleship. That's really what we're talking about here. And we have to be willing to bear those costs. There are things, I believe, that can be done. There certainly is a lot of institutional support that could be made available that isn't. Now, there are exceptions to that general problem. I have a bishop, or had a bishop, who was very supportive and very helpful. I've discovered subsequently that his motivations may not have been entirely pure. He was called as a bishop about 4 years ago, and I was in his ward. I discovered after I was married that the stake president promised him that if he would get me married, he'd be released immediately. And in fact, the day after I was married, he was released as bishop. true story. And there are other helpful examples. I think that there's a more general acceptance of this problem than there was a few years ago. Certainly there are more articles in the Ensign dealing with singlehood, although they're aimed primarily at single women. I think there's a recognition, as the Ensign, I think in June of this year, pointed out, that virtually half of all female members of the church would be single at some time in their life, after the age of 18, would be single again by the time they reach 60. I don't see quite as much support for the situation that I've discussed here this afternoon with you, although there are glimmers of hope. There is at least the possibility now, in some wards at least, of playing an active and significant role in the upbuilding of Zion. I know single members of the church who are in their mid-30s who are elders quorum presence and normal family wards. who are 70s quorum group leaders and those sorts of things. We have, as you may know, one example of a single bishop in a student ward, but it is still kind of a married sort of situation in Cambridge. Those sorts of opportunities and role models, frankly, I think are very helpful. And I think that we would be well served to try to increase those sorts of situations and give people an opportunity to recognize that they have value and have worth and have a role to play, even if they have not achieved the exalted status of marriage. Thank you very much.
I'd like first to thank the panelists, Ellen and Bellamy, Peggy and Chris. This session is scheduled to end in about 6 or 7 minutes at 5:30. If there are a few questions to the panel members, we can go over an extra 10 minutes or so. I think it'd be good for individuals to know that we will end maybe at 20 to 6 or 5:45 or shorter or within a minute if there are no questions. Keep in mind that this is a sensitive and a personal domain, so that we would request a respectful ear and voice. So if there are questions, just stand up, voice the question, and address the panel member. We have a question right here. Is the question then, do panel members know of scriptural references where the sexual activity is more of a weighty issue than normally viewed in the scriptures? Anybody read the scriptures? Anybody else want to answer that question? Bellamy would like to respond to this question before your question.
Actually, it's a good question. That's a good example, and one that I've had occasion to think about more than once. And there are other examples. My Old Testament's just a little weak today, but we have the example of either Reuben or Judah, who ended up having relationships with his daughter-in-law. And that was apparently, under the circumstances, she was about to be burned as a harlot until she disclosed her motivations. And there were no sanctions imposed upon that. So, there are conflicts, there are uncertainties, there are lots of little questions that I think arise about this general topic that we have difficulties answering. That's why I try to make the point, perhaps not very well, however, that ultimately you have to, it's really a case of working out your salvation with your own, with fear and trembling. You have to kind of decide for yourself. There are very few really hard and fast rules. And besides that, periodically the rules change. Conduct, which is permissible now, may not have been permissible 100 years ago, and vice versa. And I think that adds to the general difficulty.